into hedonistic whim, or the false incorporation or suppression of all such slavish impulse under the rubric of power. This is the elevation of narrow self-will to the highest conceivable place in the guise of ultimate freedom. I can abide by whatever values I choose, something that almost immediately deteriorates into, I can do whatever I want, or more accurately, whatever impulse grips me rules. This is simultaneously the presumption of subjective omniscience, omnipresence, and omnipotence. I have the capacity to determine the very definition of right and wrong, valuable and contemptible, good and evil. It might be objected, is this capacity not desirable? The appropriate response to that question is simple. Do you live successfully, as of now, in paradise? If not, does that mean that the cosmic order itself is of questionable validity, or that your perspective is dreadfully flawed? Better pray that it is the latter rather than the former, because there is no hope if it is the former. Better look toward your own inadequacy and attempt to rectify it before calling out God for his insufficiency. Milton's Satan is the prideful spirit who forever aims his ambition to reign, though in hell, a fate deemed better than to serve in heaven. Pride of this nature is allied symbolically, traditionally, and in the literary realm with the arrogance of intellect, the Luciferian spirit that regards its own knowledge, paradoxically, as both sufficiently sovereign and capable of limitless expansion. Faust, the protagonist of Goethe's great play by that name, is an exemplar of that prideful overreaching, driven as he is by an overweening desire for knowledge, understanding, and experience, transcending all necessary and desirable human limits. Like Eve and then Adam, Faust wants to possess more than is rightly allotted to the earthly sphere. Mephistopheles himself explains this to God. Forsooth, he serves you after strange devices. No earthly meat or drink the fool suffices. His spirit's ferment far aspireth. Half conscious of his frenzied, crazed unrest, the fairest stars from heaven he requireth. From earth, the highest raptures and the best, and all the near and far that he desireth, fails to subdue the tumult of his breast. Such motivation begs the question, is it knowledge or power that Faust more truly seeks, with all that intellectual inquiry only serving as a disguise? He certainly thinks highly enough of himself to justify the most cynical speculation concerning his aim. I'm cleverer, true, than those fops of teachers, doctors and magisters, scribes and preachers. Neither scruples nor doubts come now to smite me, nor hell nor devil can longer affright me. It is by no means for nothing that the cloak of choice for Mephistopheles is that of a traveling scholar. To return to Eve, if the current order does not serve that which is most vulnerable, and to do so is the moral injunction of femininity itself in some real sense, then it is insufficient by definition. This does not at all mean, however, that everything outside, abandoned or marginal, is properly construed as vulnerable and deserving, or that everything should be appreciated and served with no discrimination or judgment whatsoever, and all at once, or that the affectation of all-encompassing compassion is laudatory. The mere act of noting vulnerability, genuine or otherwise, by no means constitutes all that is good. The claim that it does is the essence of feminine pride, and it goes eternally before the fall. Good is much more complex and difficult than the compassion that is an instinct or a divine gift, no matter how profound that compassion might be. This means that it is in the admirable nature of the feminine to call the attention of the masculine to that which is vulnerable and not being properly served. But that call can be amplified counterproductively by the temptations of narcissistic pride, to say it again. The Spirit of God is that which warns us against acting incautiously in relation to the eternal serpent in the garden, that which advises us to beware of the temptation to take on, in the wrong attitude, more than we can rightfully bear. 2.6, naked suffering as the fruit of sin. There is a Christian conceit that suffering itself is a consequence of the sin of even Adam. This is an idea directly derived from the punishment meted out by God in the aftermath of original sin to snake, man, and woman, or earned rightfully by reptile and human alike. The prideful serpent is doomed to crawl in the dust that is simultaneously death, the presumptuous woman to suffer and serve man in that suffering, and the arrogant and careless man to toil in sorrow against the pricks and die. And the Lord God said unto the serpent, because thou hast done this, thou art cursed above all cattle and above every beast of the field. Upon thy belly shalt thou go, and dust shalt thou eat all the days of thy life. And I will put enmity between thee and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed. It shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel. Unto the woman he said, I will greatly multiply thy sorrow and thy conception. In sorrow thou shalt bring forth children, and thy desire shall be to thy husband, and he shall rule over thee. And unto Adam he said, because thou hast hearkened unto the voice of thy wife, and hast eaten of the tree, of which I commanded thee, saying, thou shalt not eat of it. Cursed is the ground for thy sake. In sorrow shalt thou eat of it all the days of thy life. Thorns also, and thistles, shall it bring forth to thee, and thou shalt eat the herb of the field. In the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread, till thou return unto the ground, for out of it wast thou taken. For dust thou art, and unto dust shalt thou return. Genesis 3:14-19. Consider for a moment the conditions of your own life. If you have not encountered the Spirit who punishes you for overweening pride, you are either fortunate beyond belief or self-deceptive to the point of delusion. It is rightly said that pride goeth before destruction and an haughty spirit before a fall. Proverbs 16:18. If you presume to be much more than you are, if you presume a caring, like Eve, or a competence, like Adam, beyond that which is properly yours, then you have taken upon yourself more than you can rightfully manage, even though you may not immediately realize it. The complexity of the world, which you have carelessly invited in, will overwhelm you, and you will suffer dreadfully. If you take on in your vanity more than you can master, you will pay the price and fail and experience anxiety, grief, shame, and pain. It is therefore an open question whether suffering itself is a consequence of the structure of existence, of our subjugation to disease, insanity, social rejection, malevolence, and death, or whether it is equally or more or even completely a consequence of the foolish self-conceit that tempts us to claim narcissistically more than is warranted. Imagine that we confronted that which is anomalous, that which is outside and rejected, in the proper proportion, that we took on only those tasks for which we were truly suited. Imagine that on the feminine side, we insisted on our capacity only for the benevolent care we could competently provide and without resentment. Imagine that on the masculine side, we admitted to the insufficiency of our conceptions without insisting too self-servingly or tyrannically on their comprehensiveness or completeness, or agreeing too thoughtlessly to adjust them merely to impress. To what degree could we then face the challenges of the world, serious though they might be, in the spirit that could genuinely rise to meet and master them To what degree could that be managed, say, in the spirit of serious play, rather than adopted as a too demanding, too burdensome, and consequently suffering-ridden venture? We desire above all, and appropriately, to find something to strive for and against. We search for an optimized challenge, not infantile dependency, for adventure, confrontation, and combat. We hope to find dragons of precisely the size we can slay, the size matched to or even slightly exceeding our levels of confidence and ability. That is the zone of proximal development, the place we play most effectively, the place we are most or at least optimally conscious. Could we not potentially dispense with much of the suffering in life, even contend most effectively against death itself, if we wholeheartedly and without reservation brought all the resources we have to bear on our problems? How much do we suffer because suffering is inevitable, given the limits of our mortal frames? And how much because we presume too much in our pride? On the compassionate side, Eve's side, we smother our children with the wonders of our excessive care so that we can benefit narcissistically and undeservedly from the praise given us by those who too carelessly observe our not at all selfless sacrifice. On the side of conceptualization and order, Adam's side, we can benefit narcissistically by falsely inflating our value to others. This means that we can put ourselves forward, and this is a typically masculine temptation, as productive and generous when we are in fact neither. This is precisely the ploy of the so-called dark tetrad personalities, the narcissists, manipulators, psychopaths, and sadists who manifest the very worst of masculine pride. The feminine equivalent has been somewhat understudied, probably because it is less likely to express itself in serious physical violence or theft. Why does the latter of these four pathological traits, sadism or delight in the pain of others, co-occur with the former three, and no doubt with the female equivalent? The proclivity to instrumentally use others for the sake of ill-gotten gains certainly allies itself with the willingness to employ force and compulsion. That, in turn, can and does transform itself into an overweening contempt for others. How else to justify the gains? And after that, into the belief or rationalization that whatever is contemptible is deserving of torture, even the belief that such torture is required on moral grounds? Maybe the weak have a lesson to learn. Maybe I'm just the one to teach them. Maybe some of that rationale is, as well, the desire for revenge on the targets of torture for being the pushovers who enabled the great sin of instrumental use and exploitation in the first place. Does the tyrant necessarily come to hate the slaves whose acquiescence, justifiable or not, forced or not, perverted his soul? Here's a fundamental question of religious faith. Do you believe that there is a spirit that both warns against and opposes pride? If, in the course of examining your own life, you conclude that you have never fallen because of pride or never been taken to task because of your tendency towards overreach, you are saint-like in the extreme, willfully blind in a manner that will lead you inevitably toward the pit, or an outright liar and doomed for that. Those are the options, as pride eternally goes before a fall. What dread spirit is it that brings about the fall? And in what manner are you subordinate to that, regardless of what you believe or claim to believe at the propositional level? It is after Eve hearkens to the voice of the serpent, insisting that she can incorporate what is in its essence poisonous, and after Adam, that primal fool, allows himself to claim similar power or immunity, that the fall itself occurs. The scales fall from the eyes of both God's wayward children. They can now see, as if they were gods, much of what they were not yet capable of consciously comprehending. They have taken unto themselves the burden of unearned wisdom. They now know, but do not know how to live with the knowledge. It is at that point that suffering in principle enters the world. Knowledge of good and evil, awareness of death, or even death itself, the expulsion from paradise, the requirement to sacrifice and work. The unhappy couple have discovered their primal nakedness. And when the woman saw that the tree was good for food and that it was pleasant to the eyes and a tree to be desired to make one wise, she took of the fruit thereof and did eat, and gave also unto her husband with her, and he did eat. And the eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew that they were naked. So they sewed together fig leaves and made coverings for themselves. Genesis 3:6-7. I have long read the enhancement of vision, the falling scales, as the loss of childhood innocence and the beginning of true self-consciousness. That man and woman alike became aware at some point in the distant past of the temporal limits of human existence, of the fact that suffering, death, and malevolence were part and parcel of life. Read in this manner, self-consciousness and knowledge of nakedness are the same thing. Imagine yourself unclothed, on stage, in front of thousands of people. This is no different than the display for all to see of your too human fragility, imperfection, and vulnerability, your inability to speak the divine words that could fill you with confidence despite that vulnerability, the impossibility of presenting your sorry self without shame. The fact of the emergence of sophisticated self-realization with maturity implies that some of the fall is a mere consequence of growth. People abandon their childish naivete, not without pain, as they come to confront the bedrock realities of life, the harshness of the natural world, the tyranny of the social world, the sinful, impulsive, and hedonistic proclivities of the tempted individual. It is by no means obvious, in addition, that our descent into the cynicism that is so often the replacement for childhood trust and wonder is not an improvement in some dark and necessary manner. Here is a paradoxical juxtaposition. The fall from childhood naivety is a prerequisite to maturity. But again, pride goes before a fall, and often in a manner that makes that fall from a far greater and more dangerous height than it strictly needs to be. So a fall seems in some sense necessary, but is definitely increased in its severity by unnecessary presumption and the desire to usurp. How to reconcile these warring opposites? I suspect that the entire biblical narrative is in some sense precisely that attempt. How do we progress forward eternally with hope intact and a minimum of catastrophe? To become self-conscious is to know nakedness, limitation, and mortality. To regard this emergent self as something bounded off from everything without. To feel alienated from intimate partner or other family member, from the broader culture, from nature, from the cosmos, and from God. To feel particularized. To become self-conscious is also to suffer from that emergent separateness, in part because everything not self, and that is a lot, can now be perceived as both limitation and threat, arrayed in some fundamental sense against the now isolated individual. With self-consciousness comes scheming, instrumental action, and a self-interest precisely as narrow as the new and restricted conceptualization of the self. To view the self as a part is also to be motivated to serve the now isolated self and only that. Why should I not be solely concerned with my own skin, precious and vulnerable as it is? Three considerations are relevant to fleshing out that question, so to speak. The first is that the experience of self-consciousness is technically indistinguishable from suffering. The second is that focus on the now narrowly and separately perceived self motivates selfish, instrumental, and manipulative behavior. The third is that the emergence of self-consciousness directly interferes with practical performance and behavior. The discovery of the relationship between self-consciousness and suffering was made inadvertently by the psychologists who analyzed the terms formerly employed to describe human personality. Personality famously has five dimensions: extroversion, neuroticism, agreeableness, conscientiousness, and openness to experience. The second dimension, neuroticism, which has also been termed negative emotionality, is the axis most useful when considering the psychological significance of inadvertently opened eyes and the consequent awareness of self. Individuals high in neuroticism are more prone to anxiety and pain and its variants and correlates: guilt, shame, disappointment, frustration, anger, disgust, and others. The researchers who derived one of the first and most influential principal personality models and measurement instruments, the so-called NEOPIR questionnaire, also discovered that self-conscious experience was so tightly allied with neurotic suffering that the former was best conceptualized as an integral subcomponent of the latter. The relationship between explicit self-consideration and anxiety, depression, pain, and so on has been studied in some detail. The social psychologist Mark Richard Leary and his colleagues found, for example, that those experiencing high levels of self-consciousness were also more likely to engage in strategies of impression management, that is, to scheme and plot to best ensure that they were being perceived in social situations in a manner they desire. Such strategies coincide frequently with the deception of self and others, accompanied by all the associated pitfalls of the lie. There is little difference between self-directed focus and suffering. That is an important realization in itself, but there is still more. It is equally true that there is a dangerous temptation associated with self-conscious suffering: the temptation to manipulate so that the painful state of subjective awareness and evaluation is ameliorated. This happens when "I must manipulate others such that they think well of me" replaces "I must place myself in continual sacrificial service to my future self and to others." The person who becomes suddenly self-conscious finds him or herself trapped in the unpleasant experience of the moment. Continual existence in such a state appears virtually indistinguishable from trait anxiety and proclivity to depression, even psychosis, as well as off painful and counterproductive social maladjustment. The consequence? Temptation to form an alliance with the snake, so to speak. Temptation to manipulate, twist, and bend the fabric of reality so that negative emotion can be reduced by whatever deception is deemed necessary. Willingness to falsify speech, action, self-perception, and the perception of others such that undeserved benefits might flow forward. Self-consciousness also interferes with performance, more objectively measured, even expert performance, as well as increasing negative and decreasing positive emotion. The emergence of self-consciousness increases the cognitive load of people speaking publicly, distracting them from the task at hand. Likewise, experts who choke under pressure often do so because they substitute for the neurological systems that now mediate their well-practiced and automatized performance the not-at-all-specialized general alarm system that produces self-reflective negative emotion. Their attention is therefore fractured, and task-specific focus is disrupted. This is perhaps part of why trait neuroticism is negatively associated with academic and career performance. What is the alternative? To attempt to not think about the self that does nothing but immediately and perversely focus attention right back on that self? Or the switching of concern from the narrow present and current whim to the community and the future. Instead of acting self-consciously in the service of the narrowly conceived narcissistic and immediate self, it is possible to act with the good of, say, your wife or husband utmost in mind, or the good of your other family members, broader society, nation, nature, or even God. It would be possible to act similarly with the personal but higher self in mind, the self extended beyond the emotional or motivational state of the moment, the self that operates optimally across the many contexts that make up the totality of experience. That more extended self is inevitably wiser and more social than the self here and now, as it must take into account long temporal spans and diverse places and situations. The next narrative segment in Genesis drives this point home. Shortly after Adam's vision is so terribly transformed, God comes to him in the garden and invites him for a walk, something the two had apparently done together previously as a matter of unquestioned habit. Adam demurs, hiding behind a conveniently placed bush. Further, he attributes his emergent cravenness to the now realized fact of his nakedness. And the Lord God called unto Adam and said unto him, "Where art thou?" And he said, "I heard thy voice in the garden, and I was afraid, because I was naked, and I hid myself." Genesis 3:11. Immediately after follows the moment when he compounds that sin by blaming Eve and then the God who had created her. And he said, "Who told thee that thou wast naked? Hast thou eaten of the tree whereof I commanded thee that thou shouldest not eat?" And the man said, "The woman whom thou gavest to be with me, she gave me of the tree, and I did eat." And the Lord God said unto the woman, "What is this that thou hast done?" And the woman said, "The serpent beguiled me," in the King James Version, "tricked me," in the New Revised Standard Version, "deceived me," in the Douay Rheims Bible, "caused me to forget," in the Literal Standard Version, "and I did eat." Genesis 3:11-13. Adam's attitude, his self-aggrandizing complaint to God, his total abdication of responsibility for his eternal fall. "Remember that woman you made for me, that Ezer Kenegdo?" In her pride and willingness to usurp, she hearkened to the voice of the spirit of the poisonous and inedible and tempted me to claim the ability to incorporate even that. Now, in consequence of my overreaching, I cannot stop seeing myself for the sorry creature that I am, and I am so ashamed that I can no longer walk unself-consciously with the true spirit of the divine in the garden. How dare she exist? How dare you make her and offer her to me? Here too lurks pride in the guise both of self-presumed right to judge woman and God and an outright refusal to admit to insufficiency, error, or sin. Instead of taking the path that could lead to atonement and even the return of paradise, Adam instead casts aspersions on his necessary and much desired partner, who is the greatest and final gift of God, and then compounds his already ungrateful and resentful and profound error by calling God himself to account. All this is the universal story of humankind in its sorrier states, the primordial and archetypal tale of the endless war between the sexes. The woman blames the man for the strictures and shortcomings of the social order, for its inability to fully encompass all that cries out for inclusion. The man blames the woman for revealing to him his own shortcomings, and worse, manifests a great resentment toward the structure of being itself. How could God have possibly made a world so terrible that it contained these terrifying, judgmental women? The biblical corpus has been and is constantly criticized for its hypothetical patriarchal bias, something so hypothetically self-evident that it does not even need to be documented. Suffice it to say, in brief but profound rejoinder, that Adam does not come off well at all in this most fundamental and determinative of exchanges. How much of our suffering emerges because we are not humble enough to learn? Because we insist tyrannically that what we already know is sufficient and absolute? Because we demand recognition for a reputation, for abiding by a code of moral conduct that we have failed to earn? Because we shrink away in cowardice from the great expanse of the unknown and mysterious? Because we have insufficient faith in the goodness of being and man? Is all that not necessarily on us? Is that responsibility not self-evidently the ultimate truth? If we were sufficiently enlightened, if we made full use of all that has been provided to us, to say it again, would suffering vanish? Would it be at least replaced by the great voluntarily undertaken adventure of life? This may seem too optimistic a conclusion. Perhaps, however, it is only too optimistic in the naive sense if the difficulty of such enlightenment has not been taken properly into account. In the Christian world, such enlightenment is technically indistinguishable from the invitation to take up the cross and tread the path of Jesus, Matthew 16:24, which is, of course, the most demanding of all paths, journeys, and attitudes, that resounding, dauntingly courageous, and apparently impossible to emulate, yes to everything, regardless of suffering. Once God discovers that naked self-consciousness has emerged in the world, the cataclysm of the fall begins. He now makes himself manifest as the spirit that sets the soul of woman in opposition to the eternal serpent, Genesis 3:15, that indicates the subjugation of Eve, however unhappily and unjustifiably, to pain in pregnancy and childbirth, and desire for a man that will in his and her sin rule over her, Genesis 3:16, that indicates the now cursed state of the ground and the consequent necessity of toil, hard labor, work, and death, Genesis 3:17-19, that sets the skins of sacrificed animals protectively between man and woman and now hostile nature, Genesis 3:21. And that decrees the now inevitable departure of his human creations from paradise itself, Genesis 3:23. Why pain in pregnancy and childbirth? There are evolutionary trade-offs between cortical expansion, associated with a commensurate increase in the size of infant's skull, and width of female pelvic opening. Any narrower, and babies would have to be born even more undeveloped, fetal, dependent, and vulnerable than they already are, to a degree essentially unparalleled in the mammalian world. Any wider, and women would have trouble running. The human birth channel is so tight that babies have developed compressible skulls to deal with the passage. None of this makes for comfort in childbearing. Why emergent authority under Adam? It is not a consequence of any evident, essential, intrinsic male superiority, say in general cognitive ability or conscientiousness, the best two predictors of general competence. It is instead, and most simply and obviously, because the increased dependency that pregnant and nursing women inevitably manifest, caring so intensely and primarily as they do for their infants, as well as dependent others, puts them at a comparative disadvantage in competing for social position and dominance with men. It is also the case that women worldwide look for men of a higher social status than they themselves possess. Without that distance, there is little likelihood of romantic or erotic attraction. With that distance, there is the risk of subordination. Why the cursed state of the ground? Is it not because increased self-consciousness and the knowledge of the uncertain future that accompanies it motivate us to toil in the present, to delay gratification, to work, to stave off privation and suffering in the future? The concepts of work and sacrifice are essentially identical. Work is the sacrifice of the immediate delights of the present to the future and to the community. The fact that work becomes necessary after expulsion from paradise means that the question of what form of work best suffices or fails, what form of sacrifice best pleases or most displeases God, immediately becomes the paramount question. Man is destined to work. What then is the great work? The form of sacrifice most pleasing to what is highest? This is the central concern of the entire biblical corpus and all its literary derivatives. Something truly indistinguishable from the issue of the meaning or significance of life, or even being itself, or even the nature of the Creator himself in relationship to man. Why clothing in the skins of animals? Is it not because that terrible self-knowing nakedness now needs protection, which can be obtained at the expense of other living things? And is it not the case that such intermediation is the very essence or definition of culture, as well as its prime purpose, standing as it does between man and woman and nature? And that the sacrifice such protection requires means that the patriarchy is by necessity soaked with blood. This means that the most primordial clothing provided by God to naked and alienated man is emblematic of the entire morally ambivalent, flawed, but still heroic cultural, patriarchal enterprise of man, undertaken by man to provide his naked carcass and soul with the protection necessary when he is no longer walking with the divine. What is the story? Man is eternally protected from the ravages of a now hostile nature by the intermediation of society, with the best protection offered by a society predicated on the voluntary offerings of God. This despite man's expulsion from his offered paradise. Why, finally, the expulsion from paradise? Because self-consciousness, an inevitable consequence of overweening pride, is indistinguishable from suffering and alienation from the divine. 2.7, loss of paradise and the flaming sword. After all this, the capstone to the chapter, the Spirit of God is also that which sets the cherubim and their accompanying sword of flame that turns every which way on the road or pathway to paradise, Genesis 3:24. Adam and Eve and their descendants cannot return to the Garden of Eden unless they can withstand the trial of those blades of fire. This prohibition seems in some real sense to be a self-evident condition of reality. There can be nothing allowed in heaven that is not heavenly, nothing in paradise that is not truly paradisal. Everything unworthy must, therefore, be cut or burned away. Is there any difference conceptually between those flaming blades and the fires of hell? Might it not be the case that the damned are damned insofar as they have established a terrifying distance between themselves and God, a distance that makes the magnitude of the sacrifice and reconfiguration necessary to reconcile their evil with God something daunting to the point of holy terror? Might it not be the case that those suffering in that manner are doing so because they have invited the darkness in and collaborated with it, such that they cannot easily forgive themselves? That would make the reality of hell precisely equivalent to eternal or cosmic justice, the necessary consequence of the eventual or even hypothetical state where nothing is hidden and everything made manifest. For nothing is secret that will not be revealed, nor anything hidden that will not be known and come to light. Luke 8:17. The errors of our pride and presumption burden us with what would have to be sacrificed or cut away. If we were to endeavor once again to walk with God, how much would we each have to shed so that only what was truly worthy of perfect existence remained? How much is our much vaunted selfhood merely layer upon layer of protective pretense, deception, or rationalization for avoidance and rejection of responsibility? How much is detritus and deadwood? And doesn't there exist a very deep rationale, even one offering a causal account, for the barring of the way to the tree of life to those who are still steeped in sin? If the cost of achieving life eternal is the perfection of the Father referred to by Christ, Matthew 5:48, then the barring of the way to the tree of life to still fallen man and woman is something both inevitable and right. What is still sinful cannot attain the heavenly reward. Paradise would simply not be paradise if it contained anything unworthy. What else might the fact of the cherubim and the flaming sword of judgment mean? That the capacity for human judgment and evaluation, essential to human subduing and naming, part of the manifestation of the image of the Word or Logos in human form, is also, and by necessity, that which excludes and forbids. This is part of what compassion, or even mercy itself in its immediate form, might well find objectionable. Nonetheless, what is painful in the short term, easily confused with what is merely cruel, may well be salutary and for the best in the medium to long term, or all things considered. Thought itself can be productively considered in this light. The process of problem formulation, creative inspiration, and critical evaluation appears very much akin in its central structure to the attempt to communicate with the gods or with God himself through the process known as prayer. As the millennia progressed, much that was originally religious became first semantic and second secular. Is it not likely that the same happened in the case of thought? Consider the stages of the search for understanding, with the first being the admission that progress is lacking on some important front. This is humility as precondition for revelation. A scientist, for example, endeavoring to expand his domain of knowledge, and by implication the body of human knowledge, must contemplate the limitations of his current presuppositions, must get on his knees, however abstractly, and open up his admittedly too ignorant and insufficient self to the possibility of learning something new. The thinker must, in other words, ask himself, or something within himself, a question. It is at this juncture that the scientific endeavor encounters the transcendent. What precisely is this self that is being questioned, as opposed, say, to the self that is questioning? If the answer is nascent within, in some manner, why did the ignorance driving the exploratory process reign initially? Why does the question have to be posed to begin with? To pose the question slightly differently, what aspect of self is answering, as opposed to the self that is questioning? Very little attention has been paid by scientists to the emergence of the research hypothesis that drives the entire endeavor. The same might be said about the mysterious emergence of the problems that confront philosophers and thinkers in the humanities, although the issue is most salient on the scientific side, given the empirical insistence that everything is given by the self-evident facts. Those writing scientific papers invariably do so as if the question they are trying to answer and the tentative formulation of solution they are putting forward as their hypothesis came to them in some algorithmic manner as the next logical or even deterministic step in the incremental progress within their field of study. This presumption is so deep, so implicit, that scientists are called on to write the introductions and even the conclusions of their research papers as if that was the process by which their investigations proceeded and the manner in which their initial question presented itself. Even if all that was true, and it is not, the next step into the unknown is never mapped in its entirety. If it were, it would not be a step into the unknown, but knowledge already garnered and mastered. Further, if the question is not trivial, a criticism commonly levied at someone taking a too obvious next step in a too algorithmic manner, then it has to be a leap into the beyond, which is what makes it daring, or when successful, a breakthrough. A research question that does not address a sufficiently hard problem, one that is in consequence truly unanswered, will attract no interest or attention from researchers or readers of the scientific literature, just as a research hypothesis too obvious will attract no funding and will disappear unsighted if by some chance it is ever published. The same obscure fate awaits a question so opaque or a hypothesis so original that it beggars the comprehension of even those on the advanced edge of the discipline. The question put forth must therefore be compelling, the hypothesis sufficiently original, within some difficult to define but communally established bounds. This means that the question must exist on the border between order and chaos. It must contain an admixture of the truly unknown. This is true for all communication whatsoever that manages to be worthwhile and instructive. It is also the case that the greater the still plausible and understandable leap forward, the more credit is instantly due the investigator or communicator, and the more revolutionary and laudable the research. The degree to which the inquiry is optimal in challenge appears to be indexed by its capacity to elicit interest on the part of investigator, peer, and audience alike. The cutting edge is by definition the most fascinating place. The identity of exploratory thought, even its most stringent scientific manifestation, with humble openness to religious revelation, is not the only place of parallel between prayer and secularized thought. Consider how the process actually unfolds in either case. First, there is admission of insufficiency. This differs little from confession or humility. There is something vital that I do not know. Contrition, I am less than I could be if I knew. Or even the religious virtue of meekness or lowliness. See Psalms 37:11 and Matthew 5:5. Before individuals think, they must have something to think about. They must be beset by a problem that is intriguing or distressing, a problem that calls or that appeals to conscience. They must believe further that the problem is worth addressing, that addressing it is possible, and that addressing it would be good, assuming, as we are going to for the sake of argument, that they are aiming up. Finally, they must as well be characterized by faith in the creative revelatory process, faith in its existence and its benevolence. Such faith is something like the belief that if you have a question, and one, say, that is genuine or real rather than false, that thinking up an answer is both possible and worthwhile or valuable, at least in principle. Supplication follows. The prayer or request for revelation that is the opening up of the psyche to insight and sacrificial restructuring. The scientist, the philosopher, the humanist, the sinner, gets down on his knees in all humility and admits to himself, his field, and God the utter depths of his ignorance. This is not an overstatement with regard to the degree of commitment of the genuine empiricist. Any scientist worth his salt is pursuing something akin to a lifelong devotion to his question of interest. In the absence of such heartfelt dedication, there is simply not enough motivational force available to a more casual researcher to do his necessarily painstaking work properly. After this admission, the searcher opens himself up to insight, something that appears indistinguishable conceptually and ontologically from revelation. The very words used to describe the revelatory experience indicate exactly the autonomy and externality of its origin. A truly inspired thought, a stroke of brilliance, it came to me that, I realized that, I saw things in a new light, I was moved, or something moved within me. My perspective shifted, the ground shifted, the gates opened up. All such language indicates, in some sense, the deliverance of knowledge. But from where? And how? And why? All this is left undisclosed when someone says, something came to me, whether it is question or tentative answer or hypothesis, and it is all simply taken as a given, say, in a scientific research report. There is yet more overlap on the creative side between the hypothetically scientific and religious practice. There is the lengthy apprenticeship of the thinker, a practice derived not from the rationalist or empiricist tradition, but from the practice of monasticism, which was in turn a manifestation of the desire to unify aim upward. This is the training of scientists to doubt even their own presumptions and to search diligently for the truth. This is escape from the tyranny of oft unexamined ideology and the enslavement to usurper and cliché that intellectual subjugation constitutes. This is willingness on the part of the thinker, scientific and otherwise, to sacrifice his previous conceptualizations in consequence of his pursuit of the truth, no matter how valued or fundamental those were. This is tantamount as well to accepting the necessity of death and rebirth as a precondition for scientific progress. Acceptance of the idea that some preconditions and commitments will have to be sacrificed and new ones welcomed in replacement. There is little difference between such acceptance and subordination of the self to divine will. This self-sacrificial and humble service is the offering most pleasing to God, so to speak, the wholehearted a priori commitment to the truth, which is to be followed no matter where it leads, like the Holy Spirit itself. The wind bloweth where it listeth, and thou hearest the sound thereof, but canst not tell whence it cometh and whither it goeth. So is everyone that is born of the Spirit. John 3:8. This is all a lot, but there is yet more to the parallels between religious practice and genuine thought. The thinker, the scientist, opening himself up to the emergence of a hypothesis, is preparing himself, as has been intimated, for the receipt, but from where, of corrective information. He is striving to become the fertile and welcoming ground on which the new seeds of the revelation vouchsafed to him find their purchase. This makes him nothing less than the bride of Christ in the symbolic language. This might be a bitter pill to swallow for those who presume that the scientific and the religious are somehow diametrically opposed. The seeking scientist, explorer, and thinker is also called upon to evaluate the newly revealed notions, making their appearance in the theater of his imagination, as in, beloved, believe not every spirit, but try the spirits, whether they are of God, because many false prophets are gone out into the world. 1 John 4:1. This is the subjugation of the received insight or revelation to critical thinking. Why is this necessary? Why would the God who reveals lead astray or deceive? This is the wrong way of considering the problem. It is not so much the source of revelation that should be evaluated as potentially false, but the motivations of the seeker and the nature of the spirit that subsequently responds. It is only God himself who speaks when called upon, when the question has been posed or prayer offered in the perfect manner. If the reasons for investigation and the request for revelation are self-serving, resentful, deceitful, and arrogant, then the spirit that comprises the essence of those impulses is what will answer. Separating the answers of the former from the falsehoods of the latter requires a painful discernment and discrimination, the willingness to separate chaff from wheat and sheep from goats. That is subjugation to the terrible flaming sword that stands at the gates of paradise. That, in turn, requires what is best understood as soul searching, an evaluation of all the potentially counterproductive motivations that may have corrupted the insight. Do I believe this only because it requires the least effort? Because it conveniently furthers my career? Because it exists in contradistinction to the theories of those I am competing with? Such assessment also calls into question the purpose or aim actually served by the new idea. Do I believe this because it is an idea that is in keeping with my commitment to serve the truth in relationship to the ethical goal toward which I am genuinely aiming? Or, once again, does it only do something for me when what is me is construed in the narrowest of senses? Such soul searching is invariably an intense self-criticism. Did I properly call upon what is highest to aid me in my exploratory venture? Or did I falter and allow myself to become possessed by concerns other than those allied with the upward striving, redemptive path of the truth? If not, what spirit did I then call upon? And as a result, what spirit answered when I sent forward my query? It is also the case, of course, and finally, that the scientist or thinker is impelled to evangelize the results of his quest. He does so by speaking and by writing, attempting to spread the doctrine of the newly revealed truth. We could make this understanding of emergence even clearer by returning to our developing understanding that perceptions are navigating functions. What we see is dependent on where we are determined to head, as what makes itself manifest to us, even in the realm of fact, are pathways forward and impediments to that progress, with everything else relegated to the realm of irrelevance and invisibility. This is equally true of what we think. Thought enables us to navigate in abstraction before embarking on our real-world adventures. What makes itself manifest to us when we question and receive a corresponding revelation are therefore the abstract equivalents of orienting directional perceptions. We admit to our insufficiencies in relation to our goals and priorities and ask ourselves the questions which, if answered properly, would move us closer to our desired destinations. Lurking behind all such admissions and questionings, implicitly, if not explicitly, is our sense of final destination and our ultimate priority. This is the spirit that occupies the peak of the mountaintop, or the ever-receding pinnacle of Jacob's ladder. That is the God we worship, however unconsciously, the spirit that guides our perceptions and shapes our emotions, as thoughts can and do make us feel. And, most terrifying, the source that answers when we knock, ask, and seek. Matthew 7:7-8. Thus, if we are aiming, however insentiently, at something other than what is highest, will produce the revelations that we are seeking. Imagine it this way. Every choice of destination has its reason, its motivation. The pathways to destinations aimed at by motivations that are resentful, immature, self-serving, bitter, and vengeful, murderous, genocidal, deicidal, will be demarcated by spirits with those natures if you pray, think, toward improper ends. Then you will be answered by demonic voices. Carl Jung noted our generalized proclivity to succumb in the most uncritical way to the slightest possibility of finding some kind of answer or certainty. Jung was describing a form of willful blindness. Later, psychologists rediscovered this tendency as the availability heuristic, the proclivity of a perceiver or thinker to judge the credibility of a claim by how quickly and easily it sprang to mind. With the psyche so susceptible to revelation and so disinclined to question what emerges, post-intuition critical evaluation is of crucial importance. We must be willing to let counterproductive ideas die. That is the sacrifice that most truly is critical thought itself. That sacrifice means that our ideas can perish, so that we do not act them out and perish. Critical thought, the death, however painful, of our ideas, however cherished, is a substitutionary sacrifice, the eradication of a part instead of the whole. As Christ insists, "And if thy right eye offend thee, pluck it out and cast it from thee. For it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not that thy whole body should be cast into hell. And if thy right hand offend thee, cut it off and cast it from thee. For it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not that thy whole body should be cast into hell." Matthew 5:29-30. The process of thought is akin to the logos, also because it is dialogical. The Russian linguist Lev Vygotsky believed that the ability to think semantically was the replication of dialogue within the mind of a single individual, that for all intents and purposes, thought constituted the abstract internalized argument between different avatars. A single mind can house many personalities. This is a truth particularly evident in our dream states, when different personalities literally appear on the imaginative scene, complete with capability of independent action and discourse. The same thing is true of the human ability to imagine fictional characters, or, more directly, the possible actions, attitudes, and reactions of other living people in abstract contemplation. The ability to hold internal dialogue, even between intensely competing personalities, so to speak, is apparently an ability that can be honed and taught. Socrates may have fostered precisely that ability, first and foremost among known human beings, formalizing, clarifying, and transmitting the technologies of thought, giving rise to philosophy as such, literally teaching people to think on their own, or at least to think far more efficiently, rather than to rely unquestionably on revelation or interpersonal argumentation. He accomplished at least this much in the course of his famous dialogues. Every idea that is alive, and that is every idea that announces itself as truly worthy of consideration, expresses itself not as a mere description, but as a personality, with an aim, a viewpoint, a world gathered around it, and a full panoply of emotional responses and associated ideas. Dialogue is the battle between the personality of various ideas. The internal dialogue that is thought is the war between competing personalities in the theater of the imagination, and the death of the losers, complete with the pain that such death by necessity entails. This process of warring idea personality within is no different than the war of the gods in heaven, played out on the broader communal scale. It is merely that war playing itself out locally in the psyche of the thinker and then in the imaginations of those affected by his thought. It is in this manner that the logos of the individual, the process of his consciousness, establishes and revitalizes the cosmic order. The need for trial by fire is further exemplified by way of analogy in the key alchemical idea, instar qualinus invenitur. Literally, in filth, it will be found. Alternatively, that which you most need to find will be found where you least want to look. The greatest challenge to what is and what should be, by consensus and tradition, is always to be found in what is least familiar and most frightening. Residing, as it does, at our weakest psychological point, it is also very likely contaminated with willful blindness. We are likely to leave unfamiliar that which is most daunting. This is why treasure and the maidens that are truly the greatest treasure are by universal agreement guarded by dragons, and also why it is sacrifice that pleases God, as the encounter with something truly new in the attempt to rise requires the abandonment of all that currently blocks movement forward. This often necessitates the sacrifice of that which is most loved. It is much easier to understand the terrible demands so often put forward by God in this light. Everything must be offered to that which is highest for perfection to make itself manifest in earth as it is in heaven. Matthew 6:10. Progress in thinking, in science itself, is dependent on willingness to confront chaos, while under the dominion of the spirit that aims upward toward the order that is good or very good. Apprehension of the anxiety, pain, hopelessness, and confusion associated with that sacrifice, the death of our previous preconceptions, is the reason for opposition to the freedom of religion, conscience, association, and thought that is the hallmark of tyranny. The tyrant rejects humility, insisting that all that needs to be known is already known. He abandons his relationship with the spirit that reveals and redeems, doubles down when his presumptions are shown to be inadequate, Exodus 7-10, falls under the sway of his evil brother, the tempter and usurper, the lord of power and of deception, and refuses the constant little deaths upon which the maintenance of life most truly depends. In doing so, or in avoiding so doing, he dooms himself and his society to the cataclysm that will eventually destroy everything. The death of a guiding idea produces disorientation on the way to enlightenment. It is apprehension of the reality and inevitability of that desert state, that intermediary grief, hopelessness, and confusion, that makes us approach enlightenment or its messengers with trepidation, resistance, or outright hostility. Would the surgery necessary to remove all that is not properly aligned or meet within us not risk killing the patient, or at least leave him or her begging for death? We so often reject penitence, even when accused with reason by those who love us and who we know love us. We reject the necessity of transformation, sticking blindly and stubbornly to our guns. We remain slaves to our own narrow, self-serving whims because we refuse to acknowledge even a hint of our own self-produced inadequacy. Who among us could therefore survive the kind of winnowing that would allow only what was best within us to stand. Thus, we avoid the healing death of the fire that is simultaneously God and the redeeming word. As the Gospel of Thomas has it, whoever is near me is near the fire, and whoever is far from me is far from the Father's kingdom. Saying 82. The cherubim and God's purgatorial weapon, the whirling, flaming sword guarding the gate to the paradisal garden, Genesis 3:24, are dramatic expressions of that complex of ideas. The essential moral of the entire biblical corpus is therefore foreshadowed in these opening stories, which unfold and reveal their implicit secrets across the millennia, as great revelations are wont to do. Another parable put he forth unto them, saying, the kingdom of heaven is like a grain of mustard seed, which a man took and sowed in his field, which indeed is the least of all seeds. But when it is grown, it is the greatest among herbs, and becometh a tree, so that the birds of the air come and lodge in the branches thereof. Matthew 13:31-32. And what is the true nature of that cutting and burning that destroys, but also plants, prunes, and redeems? How hostile is nature itself, intrinsically, with its offering of mortal vulnerability? How much suffering is intrinsic to life itself, and to be laid, therefore, at the feet of God, blamed upon God? And how much is instead a consequence of presumption and pride, of failure to hit the mark, of sin itself, and to be laid, therefore, not so much at the feet of mankind, but taken on as our own irresponsible personal shortcoming? Is that not the crux of the matter, the true cross? A stitch in time saves nine, or so goes the maxim. The Dutch build their dikes to withstand the worst storm in 10,000 years. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers built the earthworks in New Orleans to weather, perhaps, the worst storm in less than a century. Then came the hurricane. Was that an act of God, to use the insurer's term, or the consequence of willful blindness? Whenever the catastrophe of nature, state, or individual is visited upon any of us, the terrible questions immediately arise. Had we been better, would we have escaped unscathed? Had we made the proper sacrifices, would the dread spirit of the punishing God have passed over us? These are, in truth, open questions. What answers emerge from the biblical corpus, piecemeal, step by step? It is all on you, with God as guide. That is an unbearable burden, although a noble burden, certainly a challenge. Possibly the ultimate challenge. Possibly the secret to life and of the return to paradise itself. Chapter 3. Cain, Abel, and Sacrifice. 3.1. The Identity of Sacrifice and Work. With the entry of toil into the world, after the fall of Adam and Eve, the question of sacrifice emerges, and by necessity, given the close relationship or even identity between the former and the latter. The necessity for work has already been indicated in consequence of the presumption of the mother and father of mankind, sorely tempted by the blandishments of the serpent. Man and woman, unwilling to walk with God, are fated to labor, and often bitterly. Why? At least in part, for philosophical, spiritual, or religious reasons, as those who reject the upward spiraling path of the Logos must instead grapple counterproductively and bitterly with intransigent fate. If your aim were true, would the pathway forward be overgrown with thorns and thistles? Genesis 3:18. Would you be constantly inclined to kick against the pricks Acts 9:5? Or would the golden road reveal itself as a series of doors that would open if only you knocked on them, or as a quest that would enable the asker to receive and the seeker to find? Matthew 7:7-8. Could all too easily be effortful drudgery then become childlike play? Key to understanding the story of Cain and Abel, the first true human beings, as they are born in the way of all men, while their parents, Adam and Eve, were made directly by God, is recognition that it is a story about work, an essentially unique human activity. Bees make honey and beavers make dams, but neither is equivalent to the many diverse forms of work that engage human beings. Very little, if any, of the latter is reducible to the comparatively simple patterns of instinct that drive other creatures. The story of the first